Hello, and welcome to the Old Man Orange Podcast. I'm Spencer Scott Holmes.
And I'm Ryan Dunnigan, and today we have a special guest.
Derek W. Lipscomb. I produce the comic book The Maroon, and under my banner, All Eye Comics.
And you got, you got the new one coming out. You got the new one coming out now.
I currently have a trade called Kepra, which is an Egyptian superhero. Not timed for Moon Knight, but apparently that's how it works out every time I try to put it out, so.
Well, if you need your Moon Knight fix, and six episodes wasn't enough.
Right.
I'm sure it's very different. I got a few pages in, but then life happened for a minute, but I was really enjoying what I was reading.
Oh, that's, well, so the story behind this, which is funny, I actually created the character back in 1991. And at the time, Moon Knight was Marvel's Batman. And he had very little to do with the Egyptian mythology, with the gods and stuff like that, outside of the fact that Khonshu gave him his powers and he had a couple motifs on his costume that referenced it. And he kind of started out as kind of a slight inspiration. I was trying to come up with a new idea for a new character. And I said, hell, you know what? Like, I'd like to do an Egyptian, you know, themed character. I like the iconography of you know, the hieroglyphs and everything like that and all the symbolism. So I had created a character called the Golden Scarab. Not very original, of course, but I drew something up. And, you know, I did a first issue. Like, it was like literally like a 14-year-old's comic book. It was not really very deep. It was like character gets powers, fights the bad guy, the end. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to do a series. And I just never did until I the year before I left Connecticut to move out to California. I was like, well, I'm gonna break it big in comics. That was my goal after high school, which is weird because you usually think if you're gonna break it big in comics, you're gonna go to New York City, and here we are moving to Orange County. But as it turns out,
everybody else had that idea.
Well, yeah.
Nobody came that direction. I mean,
yeah. Well, my family moved to Anaheim, and that Image Studios was largely out here, and that was around the time they were blowing up, and I think what was it? There was a huge comic store that opened that my brother worked at as a manager. It was Mile High Comics.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. And they used to have all these guests come in and do signings and stuff like that. And it was like a huge buzz for people like myself that was really like, oh, I want to put out a comic. You got really like inspired. You'd go home and you start hammering out pages and stuff like that. So I started refining the character, and one of the things I wanted to do was to focus on the mythology surrounding the Egyptian gods and everything going on with it, with the underworld and stuff like that. So, yes, he basically started out kind of as my answer to Moon Knight, but I thought I was going a completely different route than what the comic was doing because they weren't touching up on all that stuff. And now, if you've seen the Moon Knight TV show now, they're doing all that. And I'm like, and so I think I had told Spencer a couple of podcasts ago when I first released it on Comic Central, I had a bunch of pages from like the mid 90s. I probably had about 12 issues worth of artwork that I never published. And I was rooming with my friend in Long Beach and I had them in a big bin. And when I moved in with my girlfriend, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, I had left it there and he's like, hey, you left a bunch of stuff in my storage. I saw you have a lot of art. I don't want to throw it away unless you come and check it out. And I went there and I saw it and I was like, wow, I actually did pretty good stuff back then as compared to now. So, you know, I was talking to Spencer and Spencer was like, oh, that should be, you know, you should just color them and throw them up on Comic Central. And I was like, okay, you know, I was already doing the Maroon, but I was like, I still want to kind of have some variety. And the Maroon is by large and far a mature title, and you know, you kind of want to have something a little bit more generalized or more broad reaching for the for your reading audience. So I just took a stab at it and I colored like the first issue. But what I did is that I started I changed the linear story of it. I took the artwork and flipped a lot of it around to tell a less linear story, and it ended up, in my opinion, working out better. And so then after, you know, I heard good things about it, I was kind of like, well, maybe I should just like finish this thing that I had started years ago, both for the reason of just archiving all my artwork and, you know, just to kind of get it out and say I did it, you know, finish what you started, basically. So, and I was telling him during the 90s, every time I was really ready to make a push to see if I get it self-published, you'd get The Mummy, you'd get Stargate, you'd get Mummy Returns, you'd get, like, Gods of Egypt. Everything would come out just when I'm like, hey, I'm getting interested in this again. And then something would come out, and I'm like,
you think that would actually help, though? You think that that would might be a good thing, be like, because, like, hey, The Mummy's popular, let's throw this out. Hey, Scorpion King.
I was thinking the complete opposite. Everyone's going, like, oh, you're just you know, riding the coattails of this, and you're trying to copy this. And I'm like, you know what? You can't win after a while. And I'm like, I just got to put it out and get it out there. And that's where I'm at now at 48 years old. So,
hey, well, there we go. It's getting there no matter what.
It's literally a 30-year in the making kind of book. And it's you know, a lot of it has new art in it, and a lot of it has restored art from back then. You know, I just finished putting together the first volume. It's like, I think it clocks at 306 pages.
Oh, wow.
And have a second volume in the works that I may put out depending on how well it does. So.
Yeah,
I just want to apologize for being the one coming in unprepared, because I'm part of the reason why this podcast is so late in the first place. So I want to apologize having a chance to read the whole thing. I only got the first eight pages in, but what I read was really good, and I love the artwork. And
thank you.
I've been meaning to check out The Maroon for a while. Spencer has been singing its praises since I think you first came on Indie Comics Club back a while. And that was also not. I mean, we can go back to talking about. The Egyptian comic in a second, but I remember he told me The Maroon is basically kind of like, he explained it as Django Unchained meets Thor, not like Norse mythology, but kind of how it adapts Native American mythology.
You know? Right. That was an idea I had while kind of just researching my own family ancestry, because there's always talk about, oh, you have Native American in your family, and, you know, this is before I knew about any DNA tests and stuff. So as I was researching it, I learned about Black Seminoles, which is like kind of this offshoot of the Seminole Indians from Florida. They're like the only tribe that really held their ground and never was pushed out fully. And I guess there was a lot of communities that they would take runaway slaves and they would join together and make these little communes that were well-armed and self-sustaining. And obviously the government was like, no, we can't have that. And so I was kind of, the term maroon comes from Jamaica originally, but it also means rebellious, self-sustaining. But it was adapted to the Black Seminole movement as well. And I wasn't really looking to do anything deep into that kind of, you know, in a political way, but I was always interested in doing kind of like a pulp style character, which is like kind of like the Lone Ranger, like I said before, or you know, Zorro or anything like that. But I was like, well, there's not really any character like that that's, you know, has that background. And the maroon just sounded mysterious to me, or mm-hmm. it sounded like a Looney Tunes insult, whichever word you want to choose. And I was like, you know, let me use this and see what I could do with it. And then that's when I started developing it, and as I was doing it, I'm like, well, I just don't want this guy to fight like bounty hunters and lawmen. So since there's a lot of Native American influence, and since there's a lot of like folklore from African American slave tales and stuff like that, I was like, let me just start merging all these things into one world and create kind of like an alternate history where pretty much the timeline is still the same and the events still happen, but his intervention kind of affects some of those things. And so I've been doing that since 2017. And since 2017, I have,
I gotta find the center.
Oops, backside. Oh. Volume 2. And then the last one I put out was volume 3. And then I have an art book too that came out.
A little sketchbook.
Yeah. So it's been a kind of a relentless thing. I think once it was getting some, you know, minor buzz, it kind of lit a fire under my ass, and I was like, I got to do this before I die. So that was really, That's really been my drive.
I remember you said it, you had like a description once. I think you were telling me and Craig this, though. But you're like, don't you just want to make sure that you have at one point before you die a bookshelf of just all your own work? And I'm like, that's a good way to look at it.
That's really like my manic obsession right now, is just like, how much material can I put out? How much content can I create and leave on the bookshelf? So like one day, like I'm gone and my kids are grown up, like, what was dad like? And they look in the mirror like, oh. Never mind.
And that's why I've always kind of described the maroon as like with like a Conan the Barbarian feel, because I think that kind of captures, it's got the pulp kind of feel to it. It's also got that kind of like, it's historical, yet it's got all the magic and mysticism in it and so on like that. Well, I'm not really, Conan's like historical, but you know what I mean? Like it has like that kind of stuff all going on, because I think that's what's kind of cool about it, is it's like it's a Western kind of ish tale. But then there's magic sprinkled in there, there's mysticism, there's dark, there's horror, and it changes. And each issue's got all kinds of its own stuff in there. I mean, it's even got comedy. It's even got all this mixture of it. It's just like, it's a real full-fledged adventure. Swashbuckling, realistically.
Don't forget about the sex and violence, because that's all that's
in this. Oh, yes, you got that.
All those ingredients are used to alleviate the tension of the situations and stuff, or to heighten it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always like stuff like that. Like, I always loved Marvel's Conan comics. They were always so, like, fun to look at. Even though I wasn't, like, an avid Conan. Like, my older brother read, like, the novels. But I always remember the comics. And the comics were always, like, wild. And, you know, I remember there's one where he's, like, on this, like, log over a big spider pit or something like that. It was on one of the covers. And, I just loved that stuff. Like, he was fighting a giant polar bear and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I would fight a polar bear if I was him. You know,
I miss that good old classic sort of adventure stuff where you're just kind of almost like man versus nature and all kinds of things like that and stuff. And then you're going to these places and you're like, I wonder what's going to be in this temple. I wonder what's going to be in this tomb. I wonder what's going to be on this, you know, ship or whatever they're going to. And just like that kind of cool stuff. And I know that like back in the day, like the reason why a lot of those adventures and things and so on is like, they're like, well, people just, you know, the average person never sees anything beyond, you know, their kind of town and county. So like you have to make these big like adventures of like, we're going to India, and we're going over to China and into Africa and all this stuff and have these high adventures and so on and see these lands that, you know, you normally would never have seen, because the only thing you would read about them is like an encyclopedia and you might get one like sketch picture in there.
Yeah. And, you know, the influences were from everywhere. I mean, it was from like Heavy Metal Magazine. I was telling Spencer, there's a movie I really love called Brotherhood of the Wolf. And that has like this kind of myth in France about like this animal that went and ravaged this country. And they made a movie about it and they tried to explain the mythology in the movie. And it was pretty interesting. But it also includes like this Native American character that does like martial arts. And it's just like a weird mix of all these things, and you're like, and it's got Monica Bellucci in it, so it's like a win-win. You're like, wow, this is a great. So it's a good movie.
I saw it streaming somewhere. It's one I've been meaning to check out for a while.
You need to. It's actually, I saw it in it had a limited release in the late 90s, and I was hearing good things about it. And we went to go see it, and I really liked it. It was good, you know. And that was one of those things that kind of stuck with me. I'm like, I like adventures like that where you have those like mysterious elements and you play it in with history and you kind of, you write your own explanation for things. And so I do a lot of that kind of in the maroon, even how history itself plays out. Some things are kind of like because of his interference. So, you know, I think that's fun. And, you know, aside from the three volumes I have, before I started working on Kepra, I started working on like a three-part origin story for him. And I was working too much on it because each part is almost like a trade long now too. I have a problem. I don't know what the hell's wrong with me, but
yeah,
this is really supposed to be one trade.
You just got the books that, you know, to take out all other books. You know what I mean? Just the size is just always massive. Like, someone be like, man, I just finished an issue. You'd be like, guess what? I finished 250 pages.
No, it's terrible. Like, so like, yeah, the three parter is the Father, the Son, and the Unholy Spirit. And I don't know when I'm going to complete that. I think I'm just going to do the two volumes of Kepra and shelve that and be good with it. I'll leave the door open, obviously. But, yeah, with that one, I want to at least get that finished and who knows how old I'll be by then, but you know, you can't, it's an addiction, you know, it's a problem.
My biggest problem is I'd get like halfway done with a comic and then like, this is fucking shit, and like start over again. So now I think I finally, after 10 years of saying that, I think I finally have the version. I'm not restarting now, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also like, you know, I have a lot of friends who have put out stuff or they're keeping up stuff and they keep reinventing. And, you know, I have one friend who looked out a series. And now he's looking at it again and thinking of redoing it. And I said, that's fine. He's like, yeah, but I already put it out, you know, the version that's kind of like the lesser. And I'm like, well, sometimes you have to do that, you know, and, you know, especially you have a lot of wiggle room if you're an indie artist. You don't get that second chance in mainstream books, obviously. If you screw up, you know, that's pretty much your swan song there. But here it's like, just start over and show people that you're just growing and everything like that. So
in mainstream comics, if you screw up, they don't let you forget. Like,
never.
One more day or something like that, or ultimatum or any number of things.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's still, people still talk about those, like the whole Spidey clone saga. And
you still get the video essay, like, 5 reasons why One More Day is very underrated or something like that.
Yeah,
you
know,
any number of things. But,
yeah. Well, even for artists too, like Rob Liefeld is an enigma because his artwork gets criticized constantly. But when I see him at the conventions, he still gets a long line of people. They probably ask him to sign like Deadpool number one, but like, you know what I mean? Like he's still doing well for himself, you know, like for, you know, the criticism he gets for his anatomy and everything like that.
I mean, it's kind of like, the anatomy doesn't always bother me. I think sometimes people like very over top. I mean, like, you know, Todd McFarlane, I think Tom McFarlane's a better artist than Liefeld, but at the same time, I think that his anatomy is not amazing. And there's just something about that. I guess if you weren't there for it, it's just like, what's this shit?
Right.
I guess there's something about that. I didn't even read comics back then. I didn't start reading comics till high school, but I still get nostalgic when I look at a bunch of like early 90s guys who went on the Image.
Well, and there's kind of there's a slight hypocrisy on that because I mean, you think about if you really look at Jack Kirby's anatomy, he even said, I invented half the anatomy because I didn't know how muscles worked. And you can see it too, like in his leg muscles and stuff. But he gets all the praise because he was an innovator at the time. And I would say the same about Image because they really pioneered comics as an art form at that point. I mean, it was already kind of getting there. But the fact that they were very art driven and their comics were very like, I mean, everything about the books, right down to like the materials they used and, you know, they started like gatefold, glossy, you know, packed in with a trading card, holograph, polybagged,
armband, newspaper stuff anymore. Like,
it's just all this stuff is in the. You're getting everything in one comic. You're like, wow, this is great. So
you're like, wow, a guy that can't draw feet did all of this.
Hey, but you know what? I would trade places with him in any day if that was your legacy and you still had that empire. Like, you know, he's. I mean, some of his characters, like I said, they made it to the big screen. Who wouldn't want that? You know what I mean? That's pretty good, you know? So.
Well, I always think that's the one main thing about comics, though, and kind of art in general, is that it almost doesn't really matter, like, because, like, the looks can be from anything. It's like it's almost how the story flows. I mean, you can have just, like, that pure, perfect almost look in the art, almost like a Jim Lee kind of style. But then you could also have just, like, pretty much, like, scribbles and stick figures. And as long as, like, it flows and works... It both of them are just as legitimate in a weird way.
Well, and at a certain point, you have to come to peace with your own artwork. If you think you're not doing good enough, like just peruse like Indie Planet and look at all the titles, and you'll see like really good, and then you'll see holy crap, you know, like it's like it's amazing some of the stuff, and you're like, maybe I'm not that bad after all.
Well, that's what I kind of learned early on is like you got to stop looking at things like Jim Lee and so on, because you look at Jim Lee, you're like, never, no,
he'll always be the gold standard. Yeah,
it's like you look at those guys, but then it's like once you start finding like Onipress, like I think that was the biggest one when I saw that company. It's like, oh, here's the company for me. I feel like I could fit in with this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny on Instagram. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Ryan. I was just making a small joke.
There's that picture that Jim Lee did of Batman standing over a gargoyle looking over Gotham, which I think was for Hush. I used to have that in my room, not far from where I drew. And then I'd just be like, why the fuck am I doing this to myself? Now it's in the living room. I'm like, yeah. No, this is inhibiting me, if anything. But yeah,
yeah, I find it's kind of difficult to find inspiration from people like that, because you just want to break your pencils more than like emulate what they're doing. And, but like, you know, there's people I follow on Instagram who, you know, I'm not one to say that, well, I think they're bad, but it's just that I look at what they're doing and they're so motivated. Even though it's like, wow, like, did you even take any kind of life drawing? Or, you know, you wonder about it, but they're still doing it. And they're like pumped about it. And I go, I want that guy's energy, because I'm too busy being critical, you know?
See, I feel like that's what I have to run off of, is like, motivation, inspiration. I can definitely carry that for a while. You know what I mean?
No, yeah. You have an infinite supply.
And you know what? It's like, if you look at my books from Pizza Boys 1 to, you know, number 12, like, there's actually a big, like, it makes a big jump in that. It makes growth. It goes to show, it's almost like, you know what? All you got to do is put the time and effort, and anybody can do this.
But you know what? That's what I like to see. I like to see an artist's growth through their course of work. And I always wonder, like, did Jim Lee grow as an artist, or is he, like, on his plateau? I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen any of his recent stuff, but is he pretty much the same as he was back in the 90s?
I mean, I feel like when you're as good as, I honestly think, like, the last official, like, not like a single issue, but like a big run he did, the last one I can actually remember is Superman Unchained with Scott Snyder. I'm not sure if he did another series. I know of like single issues and covers, but I feel like that was the last time, and that seemed pretty peak Jim Lee at the time. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe other people feel differently, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, you would think when you're doing comics as much as you do, as long as they have consistently, there would be some sort of evolution where it's kind of like, okay, I used to do it like this, but this is more streamlined, and it's either going to be streamlined for the better or for the worse. Like, me personally, I think I streamlined for the worse. but but some people, they might find better ways to, like, execute things and stuff like that. So I don't know.
Well, I remember there's that one, because the first Batman book I ever bought was Batman Hush. And that was one of the books that got me into comics. And there's that one panel where he's swinging into the camera, foot out, about to kick. And there's all these details on his boot. And, you know, after a while, he's like, I got to simplify this shit.
I know.
Every time.
I wish I could have the time and the patience. My biggest enemy is my patience. I just want to get the idea on paper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I was just like this lowly schlub living by himself in a studio apartment, I could probably spend like a year on one panel. But I don't have that luxury. So a lot of the stuff is just like, you have to compromise, you know, just get it to the point where it's, you're happy with it, and then, you know, be done with it, you know, or halfway happy at least. So,
well, and I think that's it. Yeah. You don't want to focus so hard on it that you slow down the workflow. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, it's that weird thing where you really think about when people sort of read comics, like, think about like how much you actually look at the panel. Cause it's almost like you start looking through it and it almost becomes sort of like an animation. You know, you're looking at each one and you're reading it, and you probably only look at them for give or take 5 seconds. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, it's not like you're sitting there going, let's see how to draw that boot there. I don't know about the details on the bottom there. Well, the bootstrap looks like it's on the wrong direction.
Of course, there's YouTube channels like zooming in. Yeah, like, look at how he drew a finger right here. Just look at that.
Look at it. Zooming in.
It's like reading a page out of an Anne Rice book, or like she spends 12 pages on a tree. You're like, its roots were so deeply entrenched. You're like...
Well, yeah, that was always the thing about novels. It's like, whenever they do that thing where someone's like, yo, I get it. It's a tree. It's there. It's like, the shirt's red. Just say that. That's all it is.
All you need is that. But then there's some authors who just don't spend any detail. So you're sitting like, I'm trying to visualize this as I'm plotting through. And I'm like, you know, you have to have a middle ground.
But is it collared? Is it a button up? Is it a V-neck? Maybe it's a muscle shirt. Maybe it's a parka. Maybe he has no shirt on.
Or they give you, like, the description, like, 8 chapters in, and you're like, that's what he fucking looks like? I was working through, like, I think it's called Lost Gods. It's, like, a horror book about a guy going to purgatory. And the whole time I'm expecting, the way that the guy acts, I'm just expecting kind of, like, a dude out of Greece or something, you know, kind of because it takes place like not in the 50s, but in the 70s. I'm expecting a guy that looks kind of like grease-backed hair, wife beater, this and that, you know, and then he's just like, his pale skin and bright red hair. He's a fucking ginger? You know, I don't know what it was. I was just like, I mean, doesn't ruin the story for me at all. But like, that is
I picked it up since then, though.
No. Got a little boring for a minute. I'll go back to it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean, that's always even kind of how books sometimes can, you know, can be, because I feel like that's almost like the most ultimate freedom, where generally nobody's ever going to tell you what to do in a book. See, at least with a comic, there, you know, there's a certain amount of pages you could only draw in the day. So you're never going to be there and be like, I'm just going to write, you know, over 1,000 pages of what I feel like writing. It's like, well, that's not going to happen in a comic. Well, you know, you're going to be like, got to speed up a little bit here.
Unfortunately, that's how I do my books. Like, I'll draw the pages out and I'm like, I'll worry about the dialogue sometimes. Sometimes I don't do a script, which is not recommended. But I have like, you know, the ideas in my head, and I'm like, I'm going to lay out the pages and then I'll figure out the dialogue later, just because, you know, I know I'm going to change it at some point. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, oh, I want to make sure that this detail is in this. And then, oh, but then they're going to say this in my head. And then like what was going to be a 4-page sequence ends up being like a 12-page sequence because I'm trying to cram so much into there. I mean, you know, I haven't been criticized too much on editing, like the length of things from the people I show the books to. But, you know, sometimes I feel like I could streamline stuff sometimes and I wouldn't have, you know, 3 volumes of one story I'm trying to tell, you know.
Well, I mean, myself, that's why I always like to kind of have my scripts. Like, I always call it, like, once I finish my script, I want it to be sort of, like, concrete. Not saying that you can't make little minor changes, but, like,
yeah,
this is now the testament that we are going to use to draw from. Like, I don't want it to be, you know, all the dialogue, all the story beats, all the
descriptions. It's locked
in. They're all right there. I mean, maybe I'll change a little bit here, minus out, you know, some lines there, because every once in a while you go, like, yeah, that paragraph will fit there. No, it won't. Take a sentence out.
The one go ahead, sorry, Spence.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that. And then, you know, there might be like those little extra jokes that you think of kind of as you're putting together. Like, oh, I could fit another mini panel in there, have a reaction shot or something. But yeah, other than that, though, as I said, I kind of keep it kind of concrete. Like, the final result's really not that much different than the actual script.
Yeah, yeah. I'll do an outline, like at least, take, you know, a summary of the issue. And then I'll build on that. But yeah, as far as just nailing down the dialogue, I'm always like, I'll worry about that later. And then sometimes I screw myself because I'm like, what was he going to say in this page? Like, I knew it was something good. Why didn't I fucking write it down?
Stan Lee made a career on that.
He did. And so that's my template right there.
There was one time where I did a comic with no scripts because it was all in my head, like the gist of it. Mm. And I kind of had like a little, like just a list of story beats. I'm like, okay. And it worked out great. It only worked out that one time. I work on the second
one.
If
anybody wants to see it, it's called Grit. It's about a chimpanzee with a gas mask and a gun. It's on oldmanorange.com in the art section, I want to say.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It's one of those cases where the writing could be better, but the artwork is made. The writing could be better, but it's not the worst thing. I didn't really cringe at the writing. The artwork, though, is like, fuck, really? But, you know, it's like over 10 years by now.
But it's cool in a punk rock way. See, I still like looking at it, both there's Grit 1 and 2 on there. And I feel even Grit 2 gets even more dialed in. I think if you would have kept going with that one, you know, third one, fourth one would have been super dialed in. But I think the story, the characters, it's just there in that cool kind of punk rock feel.
I think the most important thing that you should always have, I mean, it doesn't matter if the dialogue is clunky or not, just have an editor. Because I worked with some guys prior to The Maroon, and we were doing kind of like a semi-comedy book about poor superheroes. And I did a lot of work, but every time we sent something to publish, I'd get the, you know, the copy back, the physical copy. I'm like, oh, it looks gorgeous. And I would read all the typos that are in there. And I would tell the guy that would send it, I'm like, we have to change this. He's like, no, it's fine. No one's going to notice. I'm all like,
yeah, say that.
Yeah.
Well, the weird thing is like, it's amazing. Like I can read a page like 100 times and I'll never notice it. Never notice it. Somebody reads it once and they're like, oh, you just misspelled that. No comma there. And you're like, you're making me feel like I'm an idiot.
Yeah, no, you really
I don't know how to write.
my current editor, he's always like, I make the same constant mistakes, the use of commas in the wrong spot. What is it? Receive, I spell wrong all the time. Even if it's the I before E section, I screw it up. I can't get that word right, and I can't get definitely right for some reason.
Oh, I'll write this. Use a semicolon.
A lot of times, you know, I definitely is. I end up looking at it like, oh, that says definitively.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's always like, no comma here, no comma here, need a comma here, no comma here. And I'm like, ah.
One of the tough ones, too, this has actually been my new way of sort of doing it. So I have a little bit better of a spell check. It's just because when I use Clip Studio Paint, it's like, you know, when you're doing the word balloons and all that stuff, you know, you don't know what way to really spell check or grammar check it there. So I'll copy my words back into Word. Yeah. And then just use words kind of grammar and spell thing and just be like, okay, good, okay. Yep. So I kind of use that as like my robot sort of like helper.
You could just get you could just get Grammarly and have them write the whole story for you. Just like completely overhaul your ideas.
Yeah, exactly. Wait, it's suddenly the same book anymore.
It's like someone else wrote this.
Mine on the writer's section.
I know. You have to put it under writer's section by Grammarly. So, I don't know. You go, Scott. Spencer.
Okay. But yeah, it's one of those ones, like, I feel like that's that thing that you literally just need fresh eyes, and you need multiple fresh eyes. I think that's also the key thing, too, just to read over, just to catch those kind of things, because there's just always going to be stuff like that, or it's just something even sometimes missing in the background drawing that you can see 1,000 times, but then one person sees it once and goes, oh, there's this sitting right there, or there's that right there, you know?
And that's the thing, because I probably learned this from like hearing too many people talk about people like Rob Liefeld, how they nitpick everything. You know, oh, look at, you know, on this page, his belt is colored this, and on the next page, it's a different shade. And I'm just like, oh. So there's like, there are comic Nazis out there that like, they'll look at your stuff and they'll pick it apart. And I always think about that. I'm like, how consistent is everything going from like panel to page to page? You know, like, don't you have a color key? I'm like, I generalized one, but like, I mean,
the one on the computer program tells me what the colors are. RGB, I mean, CMYK.
If the sun is out and then a cloud comes in, does that, anything stay consistent then when in color? You know, like, I don't know.
I'm very forgiving towards a lot of that 90s kind of, I don't even look for it. If I notice it, I notice it. But I'm just like, you know, they're probably trying to make a deadline. They're like blaring Anthrax. Yeah. They're probably on their third surge, you know, just like, fuck, just get this shit done. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It really is.
Yeah,
it's like a race to the finish line.
Yeah, well, and that's what I think about. There's the workflow. There's so many other factors that go in there. And I don't know if this is the best way, but I like this quote from Ed Wood where he says, it's not about the little things. It's all about the big picture. And I don't know if that's the best one to take is, you know, the guy who's considered the world's worst director. But I think that quote makes sense, though. It's like, it's not about those little things. Those little things, yeah, they're all there. I mean, we can nitpick those all day long. But the big picture, what is the big picture telling you? Is the story awesome? Is it fun? The fun factor is almost the biggest one. Are you having a good time? Are you learning stuff? Does it flow well? Is the pacing good? That's the big stuff right there. Do you like the characters? Not about like, well, his boot was brown in this one, and now it's kind of reddish.
Yeah, yeah. And to give Ed Wood credit, I mean, people know about him now. So, I mean, he's got a legacy of sort, you know?
Yeah.
Don't take my statement as like, fuck Ed Wood. I have an immense amount of respect for anybody with that much like passion and optimism, you know? So I appreciate that a lot. I mean, I haven't seen Plan 3, what is it?
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
I haven't seen it in forever, but I remember enjoying the hell out of it, so he did his job.
It's, speaking of, you know, when you say inspiring, like that movie right there, I remember seeing all his ones kind of when we were growing up making movies, and it's like, that's the stuff that's actually more inspiring than almost like watching a Steven Spielberg movie. You know a Steven Spielberg movie is awesome and amazing, but like you see Plan 9, you're like, I think I can do this. I see how you can make it. I see how you make a scene inside of an airplane.
Without a budget, it can happen, you know?
Exactly. It's like, that's the more inspiring things are like sometimes like the cheaper kind of lower budget things because it says, hey, I can do this too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. So,
as this is also kind of a work in progress, we've been working on this podcast for like 2 weeks and, you know, Ryan had his wedding and that was big and everything like that. But we also have a topic that we were going to say. We're like, hey, we're going to talk about some Justice League New Frontier. And now it's been like, I probably watched this movie like 3 weeks ago by now. So it's like, I'm kind of thinking, I was looking today, I'm like, okay, I'll watch the trailer. I'll review it on Wikipedia and try to get, remember what it was all kind of about. Because it's like, even though like, it's one of my, I always tell people, it's like one of my favorite DCU movies or something like that. It's amazing. But sometimes the second that you've gone like an extra 3 weeks, you're like, wait a second, oh yeah now I remember the scenes.
Yeah.
If you watch enough of the DC animated series, some of them start to blur together sometimes too, so you're like, wait, was that the one that had, you know, and you're just trying to recollect everything, guys. I had seen this originally, like, when it first came out. Uh-huh. And I remember prior to that, I remember when it actually hit in the comic store and everyone was talking about how good it was. So I wanted to watch it. I never read the actual book itself, but I'm assuming it's a fairly close to the adaptation of it. I don't know. Have you read it?
You know what's weird is I thought I had this book, and then I realized I didn't have it. And it's kind of odd because, like, Darwin Cook's always been the guy that, like, I don't question. If I would have seen his book in a comic book store, I'm like, taking it. I see it on Comixology, taking it. Like, I don't even question because, like, I'm like, I know the artwork is already just going to be pure amazing.
Right.
Storytelling, anything he does in there. But I don't think I actually do have this one. I guess it's just, like, one of those ones I'm like, maybe it's just – I remember it just from, like, the movie and so on like that and not the book. So I'm like, I think I do need to track down this book now.
Right. I've never read the book. I do have a digital copy on, like, a Comixology sale, but I've been meaning to get around to it. I just kind of – I remember coming across a copy of it, like, in a comic book store and just flipped through it. And a lot more – like a lot of them, it looks like a lot more happens in the comic. This is one I can just honestly say I don't know how accurate it is. I do think it's ballsy that right out the gate, like, I think
– it is.
Set their second on their second straight-to-DVD PG-13 movie – they decide to make the main characters Hal Jordan and Martian Manhunter. I give him credit for that because that's at that time, like, these guys really?
Yeah, Team Green?
Yeah, right.
Wait, especially that, go ahead.
No, I was like, I think that was around the time too. There was, like, this huge Martian Manhunter renaissance kind of thing. Like, he was starting to become a more interesting character. And who was it that was writing his book at the time? Oh, man. And I think he was doing the art with Texeria. Oh, who's the guy that was writing it? Oh, man.
Would this have been like the early 2000s?
Maybe earlier, maybe late 90s. He had a really good run.
I have one on my shelf meaning to read. Let me see if this is the one. Lieberman, maybe? Was it Lieberman?
No, it was somebody else. I know it was... Was it Robinson? I can't remember. But anyway, it was a good run. It had great artwork and stuff, and I think people were really getting a lot of interest in the character again. So they probably wrote off of that for this book, and then, of course, the animated movie, too. It was probably a great idea for them to put that through.
So. You know what? It just crossed my mind. The reason they probably threw in Green Lantern is probably because he's getting people ready for, like, the Green Lantern movie they had planned. I'm just now realizing that.
I definitely think that it's funny because, like, Martian Manhunter is getting all this credit here and so on like that. But it's like right when New 52 comes out, that's when Martian Manhunter kind of gets the boot out of this. Like, okay, get out of here. I thought I was part of the Justice League. You're like, not anymore, but I have been since the beginning. I was in it before Batman and Superman. Come on.
Well, I mean, he was never really like a classic character even prior. Like, you think about, like, the Super Friends or, like, no, what is it? What was the line of toys that came out after the Super Friends show hit?
Kenner or something?
Yeah, Kenner put out and they had, like, a cartoon to go along with that, and he barely showed up in that.
I know which one you're talking about.
Superpowers.
Superpowers, yeah.
Spencer has a couple.
Yeah. And he was in it. I think he had a toy in it, but they were really never, like... He never really felt like he was part of the Justice League there either. He's just like, in one episode, Martian Manhunter will show up.
It's such a bummer because I think he's such a cool character, but I don't know if it's just that thing that, like, yeah, he just is kind of like, maybe people like him, but they just don't like him enough to put him sometimes in, like, the top list. But it's cool that in this movie, he's getting a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
I mean, and then also top, this movie is ballsy. I forgot how ballsy this one is, right? I mean, like, right when it starts, once again, this is like DCU's new line of films where they're kind of going, okay, we're the second one out the gate. The beginning of the movie just starts off of just death after death after death.
I mean,
there's literally that guy writing the suicide note, shoots himself in the head. Because all you can think about is that this time period, this is still like nobody really realizes these are PG-13. You could just see a mom's going to Walmart and she'd be like, okay, little Billy, you want the new Batman movie? Well, here's one right here. It's in the kids section.
I know. I told you I had started to rewatch it, and I only got halfway through because I turned it on while my kids were in the living room, and I was like, oh, it's cartoons, superheroes, they'll be good with it. And then just people are just getting capped left and right. And I was just like, and my daughter's like, Dad, can you turn this off? I'm going to have nightmares. I'm like,
that alien man showed up at that guy's, like, observatory and he had a heart attack and died.
Or about to stab a child.
But he was almost happy about it because he saw an alien.
I'm like, I want to get my kids in the comics, but this is not the route. I can't do it. So.
They do, because it is. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, because it is like surprisingly, I mean, you know that you see it's PG-13, but I feel like even for, I feel like if it was live action at this time, it probably maybe would have skirted R, but I think this is the time where they kind of like, it's a cartoon, it'd be PG-13, whatever.
Under the radar.
Yeah. What?
It's under the radar.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, because like you said, there's opens up with a suicide, a guy writing a children's book, and that's the end, kids. We're all going to die one day. Bang. And then, you know, how it's silhouetted, but then Hal Jordan blows a dude's brain out right after, like, crashing his plane. And then,
but I mean,
there's like, oh, then there's a child about to sacrifice to, like, the center or whatever, you know?
And look at the cover art right here. It just gives you this sense of wonder and grandeur.
Yeah.
And, you know, any kid would be like, this looks great. Yeah, they have no idea, like, the brutality that's waiting in there.
Well, and I feel the whole point was to go, like, we're going to give it that 50s sort of, like, comic book, like, charm and, like, that kind of era and where everything kind of has, like, that almost, like, clean, like, metallic, like, you know, just it's just like the way cars were built and everything. Everything has, like, it feels like it's perfectly crafted in a way and so on like that. But it's going to be dark and it's going to be violent and there's going to be dinosaurs and all kinds of weird stuff going on. Like, it's got that 70s, like, sci-fi kind of bizarre stuff. Or, I mean, 70s, 50s, you know, bizarre sci-fi stuff going on in there. You know, I mean, even Hal Jordan, like, when he crashes that plane and he's down there in the Korean War and there's a guy there's like, they have to fight the struggle. And he has to kill a guy. He's just like, never killed a man before. I mean, I've shot a bunch of them down in planes, but that doesn't count. They're not real people if they're in planes.
I love how Wonder Woman has, like, that, like, that whole, like, war party with all the females after they slaughtered all the men.
He's like, whoa, Diane, what are you doing? And she's just like, hey, we're getting drunk, we're having a party. Don't be coming to crash it in.
They're all wearing necks with, like, dicks hanging from them.
Looks like that scene of Your Highness where he puts, like, the minotaurs, like, clean around him.
You know, it's funny, when you told me that we were going to review this, the first thing, like I said, I hadn't seen this for, like, I don't know, over 10 years, or I don't know how old this thing is, but, like, the first thing I could only recall is, like, is that the one where Batman has the weird-ass voice? Because the guy they got the plane, like, not the typical Batman voice that you would expect. So when you hear it, you're like, whoa, like, he's got, like, a really weird, like, gravelly, I can't describe it, but it's not like the, you know, the Christian Bale, like, you know, husky whisper, you know, like, it doesn't seem that.
It's definitely something different there, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, well, the one thing that's cool, though, is this is the one where they actually have Lucy Lawless play Wonder Woman, who I always thought would have been the perfect Wonder Woman. I know that by the time the newest Wonder Woman came out, that, you know, too old as in being in her 40s. And you're like, well, is that too old? I mean,
Ben Affleck's older.
Yeah.
They do that.
They do that stuff with
Hollywood magic and make her younger again.
Yeah, just press the magic button on your Hollywood editor and everything works out. But yeah, it's like that thing where it's like it actually has some interesting voice acting. But yeah, Batman does have a completely different, you know,
different voice. And it's like it's jarring at first. So one of my favorite sequences, though, is that the whole Las Vegas scene with the Flash and Captain Cold.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a huge Flash fan anyway. So that part was always like really that always stayed in my head, like that whole confrontation, and he had to go and chase out the bombs and everything like that. Yeah. I thought that was great. Yeah.
Well, do you think it was supposed to be Bing Crosby that they killed right there?
I think so.
I'm gonna tell you, baby. Just like, oh fuck! It's just like how they just like just no pun intended. Just want to ice them right there. He just
this should be like
shatters.
They should be like, this is for your kids.
Yeah, it's like just to add. I like how everybody's story has somebody die in it, pretty much.
Right.
Does Batman's story have someone die? Or is he the one where he's investigating the little, like, kid almost getting taken away to the cult meeting?
A child is about to get stabbed, and Batman steps in. And then, like, the Martian has to, like, dude, you're fucking freaking the kid out. And he's about to get stabbed by a demon, all right?
It gets all crazy at the end, though, with the big floating island thing with, like, all the little weird, like, mutants or whatever on top of it. And
which, if you said Keith David was doing a voice of something and you said it was the island, I'd be like, Keith David is voicing the island that monsters are pop? Okay, all right.
Keith David can do a voice to anything. I mean, I hear his voice. When I write Kepra, that's what he sounds like to me.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, when you read it going forward, that's what you're going to hear in your head.
I always just think of the line whenever I hear his voice, even when it's like the Arbiter in Halo or whatever. I just think of the line from Requiem to a Dream. It's like, I know it's pretty, baby, but I didn't pull it out for air. I just think of that line.
He's a national treasure, man.
You know, he's doing a voice in Gravity Falls. You know, that's the first thing I hear.
No, he's like the ultimate of voices. But yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like, yeah, it's like, that's what you use them for in this one, is the island. I mean, whatever, it's cool. Something. I mean, this movie does do the thing where it fits a lot of stuff in here. I mean, all these characters get a lot of moments. It fits a lot of villains, heroes, all sorts of stuff. And it all works out kind of in a way. And it's like, even at its hour and 20 minute or so runtime, it still feels like, has like a very epic feel of almost like a 2 hour long, if it was a live action film.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, like, even to get to that third act, like, the whole middle part feels so jam-packed with, like, different stuff going on. I was like, looking at it, I was like, man, like, I don't remember half of this stuff when I saw it the first time. So I remember the beginning and then the end, and that middle part, there were certain things I remember, but I'm like, I don't remember all these other details.
Yeah.
So it's a dense movie.
I remember, like, just being at the time caught off guard that, like, it focused mostly on, I know I already said this part to an extent, but like Hal Jordan, Martian Manhunter, and then secondary, probably like Barry Allen. And then after that, more of like Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman were more there just to sell the movie. But I kind of appreciate it because they have their moments, but they shadow it. Like, they kind of do everything else. And don't get me wrong, Batman's my favorite character, and I like Superman a lot and Wonder Woman. But at the same time, I'm glad they give these characters who at the time didn't have a whole lot of things that they were in, give them a moment to shine and kind of really take the wheel.
Yeah. No, especially because even later on, I mean, even though these characters just kind of barely in, but it's got like, you know, Green Arrow shows up and they have like the old school Green Arrow before he has like the goatee and everything like that.
Challenge of the Unknown.
Challenge of the Unknown. You get
Strange.
Yep. Yeah, there's just all kinds. And then this kind of just has all the kind of cool, like, 50s versions of all these characters and whatnot, too.
I know they get it out of the way early on. I do think it's a missed opportunity not to have the Justice Society there. They say, oh, yeah, they scared them off. But at the same time, like, which I get for part of the story, but it would have been nice to see them, more of them, in the middle of the fight, you know?
Oh, yeah. That would be great, too. I was considering, like, the time period. It would be nice to kind of put them in there. Mm-hmm. So, but, yeah, I was really surprised rewatching it how violent it was. That was my first takeaway, and then like how dense it was and how many characters, like you said, they tried to fit in there. But and then like almost everybody's story has some form of, like I said, brutal moments in there. Like, they're not letting anyone get away with it in this, and so. But yeah, it's kind of like the sign of things to come for the animated movies after that, you know, because they've increasingly tried to push the envelope more and more with each one. So,
yeah. And it's like this one here, it's like, you know, they've made like almost 50 of them by this point. And this one, I still think ranks as one of the top ones that they've ever done. Like, it's so good. Like, the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, man, I'm like, I knew this one was good, but it's just been like probably 10 years since I last watched it or so, you know, but it's like, I almost do that thing where it's like, I forgot how good it is. I know it's good and I know I like it a lot, but I forgot how much I really enjoyed this one.
I would love to see a live action version of this, adapted into the movie.
Oh yeah.
Cause I mean, it's so self-contained, so it would be perfect. You know what I mean? Like, there would be none of the like, oh, what's going to happen next or anything. Like, just a nice, I think they just need to do that now with comic book movies. It's like, you know, no stingers or what's, you know, hints and laying Easter eggs and stuff. Just do like a standalone, you know, a big spectacle style movie like this, but close it off at the end and that's it. You don't have to worry about
total one and done. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just a brand new cast. It's, you know, Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman. They're all new actors and everything like that. Whoever else is in here, it's just like, and just do it like that and then do another one like that. Like, that's kind of like what I would hope that movies would kind of start doing instead of having to always be so linked together. It's like we keep getting stuck in this. I think the downfall is also because of the Marvel popularity of having it all contained. And it's like, that's cool in itself, but it's limiting to the fact that you only get one style now. You don't get the trial things.
After a while, the Marvel, you know, the whole thing with the whole shared universe is only for the comic fans after a while. Because, like, the general audience, they may skip a movie here or you know, not see one of the TV shows. Like, in case I I'm hearing like this Doctor Strange movie. It's like, if you don't see WandaVision, you're going to be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, you know, like,
why did she? WandaVision.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that's what I'm hearing.
I will say, I did have to ask Ryan. I'm like, what did I miss out on WandaVision that's going on in this movie?
I heard this is another one you don't take your kids to either.
the last act of the movie is basically a Sam Raimi movie. I mean, PG-13 yeah, well, Sam Raimi movie, but real Sam Raimi movie.
Yeah, it's like Evil Dead, Drag Me to Hell.
I'm looking forward to that. I can't. Is it? Do you guys like it?
I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty neat.
Yeah.
I say I was a little like slightly underwhelmed, but I still overall liked it.
That seems to be like the general consensus on that. It's like some people liked it, but they weren't like it wasn't like a top five or anything like that. So
it was kind of like, I guess it was for being something called the Multiverse of Madness. It seemed a little simplistic. Where Multiverse of Madness, I get the sense of urgency, all this shit's happening all at once, let's figure this shit out, you know, so it's okay.
It should be like watching Speed Racer where it's like an acid trip, you're like, oh my god, the colors, I can,
but at some point it's just kind of like, at some point the movie's kind of, all right guy, just give us a minute, we'll be in these three universes only, and we'll just give us a minute, we'll get there, we'll figure it out, you know, and then like, okay, so it's kind of a little like, it's not as chaotic as I thought it would be, and then the last act is kind of like totally one
bonkers.
I was already enjoying it, but the third act goes full like Sam Raimi, other than no gore really, but you know what I mean.
So the few universes of madness is what it should be called.
Three universes of madness.
A couple of universes of madness. A couple universes of craziness.
Yeah, exactly.
Poster just strange up, just like, I guess, you know.
It's almost one of those ones where like the poster and just like the kind of promoting it makes you just, it makes your mind wander, and it's like, I mean, you, no matter what movie, it's like sometimes your expectations are built up too high, but that one does do that sort of thing where you just expect like the possibilities are too endless, but the downfall is that everybody's probably got their own idea of the possibilities are endless type thing here, and it still delivers, it's still super fun the whole way through, it is action-packed and the pacing's good, so I mean, nice. Like, it is definitely enjoyable. I definitely say go out of your way to watch it, because I definitely liked it more than many other like Marvel movies.
But
it is one of those ones, like in your mind, you just can't help but go like, oh my gosh, you could do this. And what if they go to this universe here? And what if there's these kind of alternatives and so on? Yeah.
Well, I heard they had like 40 minutes they cut out of this movie on the floor.
I heard that too, yeah.
And I was kind of like, well, what are we missing? Like, you know, this...
Tom Cruise as Iron Man or something like that.
Yeah.
Nothing that big. Like, we paid a lot for that Scientologist to come in.
But maybe one of these days there can be an extended one, even though you never see that in the Disney section.
Never.
But I'm going off kind of like extended and kind of like Snyder Cuttery stuff. I do feel like that, because you were saying, Derek, that it'd be cool to see something kind of like this in a live action, like New Frontier, which maybe not New Frontier exactly, but I could honestly see the Black Adam coming out having some of that, because the Justice Society is in that. They're not really in. I know they're not in that, but I can kind of see just this. If it's something going through the ages, I can almost see them presenting different heroes through the timeline, and out of that, seeing like, let's see if people like them, and maybe we'll get a Dr. Fate movie, or maybe we'll get the Adam movie or something, you know?
Right. So, I mean, I don't mind the ongoing. As a comic nerd, I don't mind the ongoing saga, like what the MCU does. But there's times where I just want to have a movie where I can, like the Batman was phenomenal, because I feel like you could have just ended it there.
Yeah.
You know, even with the implied Joker being in Arkham and stuff like that, I felt like that was such a good movie. It could be a standalone and I would have been good with it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's my favorite Batman film, and I never thought I would say that. Because I really love the detective aspect that they played up on him.
Well, and I think that's the best part of it, is they finally kind of got that detective part nailed, which has always been the ingredient that it's been there in certain ones, you know, but like they never have like hit it really hard on that. And I think that's kind of the thing, is like, that's what Batman is first and foremost. It's a detective story and you're solving mysteries and going through like that. And then you kind of amp it with some superhero action, throwing punches and so on.
He happens to kick your ass too.
There's like a partway horror film too, which I really appreciated.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really kind of opens up new potential for, you know, his films, because, you know, obviously we've had a lot of Batman films. And I think they each do a good job of specializing an aspect of the character. Like, you look at the Burton / Schumacher ones, and you can get, like, the zaniness of, you know, the colorfulness of, like, you know, the villains and everything. And, like, the real surface-level Batman stuff from those, and they're really fun. And then with the Bale ones, you get, I think the difference between the Bale one and this one, which I really liked about this one, is that I liked that it was like his year two, and it showed him still kind of struggling with his role and what he, you know, what he's good at and what he's not good at. Where Bale kind of just took off running once he was Batman. Like, you didn't see that interim space where he was like, oh, I made mistakes. You know, what I, you know, it wasn't as implied. Not knocking those films because they're great too, but, and I've always favored Batman Begins over the two sequels. I don't know why. Yeah. I always like the early years of Batman. So
Begins and Batman Dark Knight are kind of like tied for me.
Yeah, Dark Knight,
those two are right. Dark Knight Rises I liked, but it was still a little. It wasn't Batman enough for me, and there was also like, it's not the pacing threw me off. The how do you get back to Gotham? It's like he's fucking Batman.
Yeah.
That's why I got back.
Yeah.
To Gotham.
Yeah. I think I like the first half of that movie, and that's that's where it goes.
It's the double rise. He rises too many times in that movie.
He comes. He's rising out of retirement. Gets his back broken.
Rises again.
Rises out of the hole in the ground.
Yeah, I feel like if he gets his back broken, it should be like that thing. Like he should be so on top already. Like nobody can take him down. Almost that kind of feel. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like he's heavyweight champ, and then all of a sudden he's
Rocky in Rocky III. You know. That clipper leg is Bane.
Yeah, and you're like, what the? Oh my gosh! You got to start working on everything all over again. That's how it needed to be. Not like, yeah, I'm giving up. I'm gonna look like Green Arrow walking around my house.
That would be funny if Rachel was still alive and Bane's like, "You want a real man? I'm a real man." Batman's like, "Oh, I'll kill you!" Gets his back broken. Oh!
Now I wish we always had Mr. T as Bane.
You know what? I like Tom Hardy, but I'm all for that. I would have doesn't even bother changing his voice. Same thing. It's the mask. You know, like it's uncredited. We're gonna let you guess and figure out who it is. Like, oh, we fucking know.
You know how much more intimidating that is.
The mask.
Well, I love the idea of also treating it like a Rocky movie too. So it's like you got the training montages, you got the building up and everything like that. It's got the great soundtrack.
You somehow get Burgess Meredith back in there somehow.
He's both the Penguin. I need you training again.
He's both the Penguin and on his side. Bruce, you gotta get out of there. Bane punches him. Shut up, old man.
I just love the idea of just like the Penguin just starts living in Bruce Wayne's house. Like, hey, you dated my sister.
It's got to get made somewhere. It's got to be a mashup.
Maybe that's in The Batman 2.
Yeah.
Colin Farrell in the fat suit just chilling on the couch on Wayne Manor.
Well, guys, then we could almost have, if we're going this way, you could have Carl Weathers play Two-Face. I mean,
oh, perfect. Oh, perfect. Perfect.
It's one of those ones. I wish they would have continued if the Lando was Two-Face. I think that's like would have been like the coolest thing.
I know.
Like, that's such a cool setup. You see that in 89, you're like, oh, this is going to be neat. This is going to be cool. And it goes out the window.
Nope.
I heard something that I don't know if this is a fact, but I heard that what was going to happen was there's the Max Schreck, the Christopher Walken character in Batman Returns, who's a made up character. Mm-hmm. I heard that was originally supposed to be Harvey Dent. And at the end, he was going to get his face charred instead of die. Because remember, when she kisses him, she like,
oh, she has the yeah.
It was going to fuck up his face, and he was going to be the villain for the third one. But like an opportunity to work with Christopher Walken arose, and they rewrote it to be some other character. And it's just like, God damn it.
I know.
Tim Burton. I like Christopher Walken
too. But I think he's great in that movie. But the possibility of seeing that happen would have been great.
Well, plus then just having the second Batman movie have that thing where it's like, oh, it's, you know, not only is it Catwoman, Penguin, but then you also have Two-Face in it as well too. You make it feel even more epic. But
I love Batman Returns. A lot of people are like, oh, that's kind of down and droll. And I'm like, that's perfect. I love that one. I think I've seen that one the most in the theater. I watched it almost like every week after it came out. I remember I just moved out here. And it was like a 99-cent theater down the street, and I'm like, I got nothing to do.
Air conditioning. Let's go in. Let's go hang out.
The funniest thing about it, I was working at a Blockbuster Video at the time. That was my first job out here, and I was watching it all the way up until the video release, and then I bought the video.
I need my fix. I need my fix.
Yeah,
I had the novelization. I had the comic book tie-in version.
I have the McDonald's like cups.
Yeah. Oh.
I remember because they said the reason why they went so soft on the I mean, they always bring it down to the Happy Meal thing, but I think that's over exaggerating, but it definitely probably played a part. But the idea that he's going to kill children on Christmas Eve by drowning them in cold sewer water.
Yeah.
By the way, kids, get the Happy Meal. And the thing with that is just like, I mean, that sounds very Batman if you read the comics. I know people going in like, oh, I remember the Autumn West cartoon and going and see that. Like, what the fuck is this? You know,
I mean, that was the biggest thing. And it's just to kind of bring things full circle. It's funny because that was at that time too, where like, if you were trying to do comics, you still had the Adam West thing hanging over your head. Yeah. So as a creator, everything had to be like dark and grim and gritty and serious. Like, I remember I would meet with a bunch of people who were going to do a comic, but we got to go serious with this. Like, get so mad.
Angry.
Yeah, we got to prove ourselves that we're serious business. You know, like, we're an art form. We're not some joke.
Every indie has to be bittersweet. The hero can never win. He's got to lose something every single time, but he still keeps going forward.
Give him a lot of pockets on his belt. That too.
Yeah, pockets are awesome. How many protein bars can you stuff in those?
I'm at a convention table. You want a real book? I'm a real book. Come over here and buy my book. This ain't no Adam West.
Full on like Scorpion, like, get over here.
But that was like the drive. Like, everyone was trying to be like this whole Dark Knight influenced kind of, you know, feel to their books. Like, you look at almost anything and everything had to have something like something really like, oh God, this is not for kids, you know. Like, even like when Kyle Rayner became Green Lantern and the whole Fridge the Girl thing came out, it was like,
oh yeah,
everyone was talking about that, like, oh my God, like, it's a girl's dead body stuffed in his refrigerator. It was like a big deal back then, and I didn't even realize it was a phrase until like a couple of years ago.
Well, when they said fridge, I didn't realize that was literally from a comic book they took that from.
Yeah, that's where it started from. I guess it was like a criticism, and you know, I'm guilty of doing that in the Maroon apparently. But like, the criticism is like killing the girlfriend to motivate the hero to do something big, and now it's kind of like, well, I mean, you kill anybody; it doesn't have to be the girl. I mean, it just whoever you love or care about would make you do stuff. So, but
it's
nine times
John Wick, you kill the dog.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, Fridge the Dog, next is going to be the next thing. So, but yeah,
I think it has its place here and there, depending on the moment, depending on the book. I mean, it's a beloved character like Batgirl, I get the criticism. Right. But if it's somebody it's a case-by-case basis, I feel like.
I think so, too. I think if you execute the story well enough, it won't be, you know, it shouldn't be viewed as just like, you know, I think the criticism was that it felt really frivolous. And it wasn't really an earned thing, you know. I mean, because you look at the character of Kyle Rayner, he was an artist, and you know, he wasn't really like. I guess everybody had to be some sort of tortured figure in comics at that point. You know, back to the grim and gritty.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I lost my toe. I'm gonna go and fight crime. You know, like, just there's always something. Yeah. Like,
Aquaman loses his arm saving his son. You know, like,
now he's gritty. Yeah, now he's a grim and gritty Aquaman.
Who took the last Pepsi?
My Twinkie.
And also, one of my favorite parts is everybody had a mullet in like the early 90s in like the Justice League. Even like Wonder Woman
had a perm.
Superman had the power mullet, though. His was it was crazy. It was
one of the best ones, though. One of the best ones. It's like one of my favorite pictures is there's like the very first of the Nightwing issues where there's this image that's in there that's just amazing. It's where Dick Grayson's laying on the bed with his arms back and everything like this. He's wearing nothing but underwear and whatnot, just ripped more than Batman or Superman or any of those guys combined. Hairy chest, big old huge, like old 80s chain. Hair metal, like mullet. Yeah, just like, I've always called it, that's Man Wing right there.
It's literally like Dog the Bounty Hunter. He's just like, yeah.
Yeah, just like, hey, what's going on? Yeah, I was out fighting crime today. That's the best one. And after those first six issues of Nightwing, that look goes away. It's like that. It's only in that section there. It's like, I love those ones. It's written by Dennis O'Neill and everything.
Didn't the animated series adapt his mullet at some point?
He does have the mullet in like the Batman one in that section there. But this one, he's got like the flowy one where it almost looks like he's got like the rock star. Like, it's so, and then combined with the hairy chest and just, I mean, it's just as jacked as all can be. And it's Nightwing, so it's just so much better that way. It's like, Man Wing, come on.
I read that arc. I read that arc not so long ago, and there is this part where it's, I still really liked it, but I was just like, they're trying so hard to make this thing super macho. There's this part of this girl, because like he's at the beginning, he saves a girl and she's wearing glasses, and she gets like knocked the fuck out, and then he's like, wow, she's really pretty without her glasses on, and she's just laying there with a fucking bloody lip. Like, just, what am I saying? I gotta save her now. Just like, God, I thought she was a fucking hideous troll up until she lost those glasses. Shit.
They should have renamed it Jacked Wing, because he's always like so cut and shit.
Glasses make her look like an unfuckable like nerd, but, God,
but now,
without him, but now, right, she's... She's Cindy Walker or Cindy Cropper, whatever her name is.
Well, that's literally like Gen 13, because it's like the main character, whatever Rachel or whatever the heck her name is, like she has the glasses on and like she's got books in her hands and so on like that. And then it's like literally she gets her superpowers, it's like boom, big old chest, glasses fly off, books get burned.
Dude,
I don't need to read anymore.
The '90s comic art was so exploitive, it's hilarious. And it's funny because when I was going through my old art doing Kepra, I'm like, I was following a lot of that, like the female character in my book, I'm like, and she's like super buxom. I'm like, this is not realistic, but I'm going to keep doing it.
I'm going to go with it. You know what I mean? It's a comic book, damn it.
Consistency is everything. Like, let's keep this up.
Are you committed to the first panel? Got to keep going.
Well, I established the look.
Remember, comic books, it's the keep most important all. Thing. You still need just that ever so slight over the topness. Just ever so slightly. You know
everything's
what I mean?
Heightened.
Yeah, heightened. There we go. Because I think that's really important and whatnot. But well, I know we're kind of, or at least I know I'm running out of time. I'm sorry. I feel like we're having such a good conversation. I'm like, okay, guys, I'm going to stop the train here. Get on off, everybody. Okay,
I don't want to go to school.
I think you can call this one like, you know, like with like hanging out with Derek. With a little dash of Justice League.
I gotta alter my poster that I made. I tried to make the poster beforehand so that I had it so it'd be like that. But I'm like, well, we got a little bit of Justice League right here and a whole lot of us. But
those are the best ones, though, when you get to shoot
it
shit.
Is. Yeah, we know we need to definitely do this again, Derek. I mean, like, we always say this because we always have a good old time on every single one. But
absolutely.
There's all sorts of stuff. You know what we should do? We should do the Wolf movie. That should be the next one we do.
Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Brotherhood of the Wolf. Because I know we talked about that before. That would be fun to do. We should.
I would love a little rewind review on that,
and go from there, and definitely do more podcasting, do more comic books, and all that kind of stuff to talk about because it's always fun. We always get inspired, you know, just creativity, like just good times being had, and all that stuff. But beyond that, Derek, where do you want to send people to get the Maroon? I know Indie Planet's mostly where I always send people, but do you have anywhere else?
Yeah, if you want to get the physical copy, Indie Planet is where you can start. And just look it up under the Maroon. And soon, Kepra will be there, hopefully soon. And then if you want to just buy digital, you can go to Amazon and look me up under there. They just put the Maroon comic and the full series I have so far, which is about 18 issues. And the three trades and the sketchbook are all on there. Yeah, and then you can also go to my website, which is themarooncomic.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. I haven't updated it yet this year, but I will be doing it once Kepra comes out. And I have it's like a hub for everywhere. There's links to Comixology and to all other venues that I have selling it digitally. So, and I'm also on Twitter at Alawai Comics, as you can see down here, and then on Instagram as well at the same handle.
Perfect.
And that's it.
So yeah, it's good you got both the same Instagram and Twitter one. My name wouldn't fit fully on Twitter, so that's why I have the S on here. And then it's Scott Holmes on Twitter and TikTok, or not Twitter, Instagram and TikTok, just because I can actually fit it on there. But
nice.
That's
really good finding this. Yeah, absolutely.
But beyond all that, you can always go to oldmanorange.com. That's where you'll find more of the podcast, Pizza Boys comics, old animations. You'll find Grit on there. If you want to check out Grit 1 and 2, Ryan's old comic, it's there. Chimpanzee gas mask gun. Chimpanzee gas mask gun. Like, I don't know. Like, how does that not sound amazing? Look at the cover.
A lot of spelling errors, too.
It's not mirrored. But, it's all about the big picture. But till then, I'm Spencer Scott Holmes.
I'm Ryan Dunnigan, and our special guest,
Derek Lipscomb.
And we'll see you some other time.
Later, folks.
Later.